welcome to the Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles, and I've just returned from a great week at the Cape Cod Writers Festival. It's an annual event held in Hyannis featuring a wonderfully diverse curriculum for aspiring writers. Festival organizers assembled an impressive faculty of writers, screenwriters, literary agents, and more. Over the next few weeks, I'll be sharing my conversations with folks I've met there. But this week, I've decided to pay homage to New England, spotlighting the region's remarkable writers. Vermont, New Hampshire, Massachusetts, Maine, you'll be hearing some wicked good selections. Let's get started as we turn to page one of the book report.
Traditional advertising can be expensive and wasteful. But lately, you've been hearing a lot about social media and viral marketing. But let's be honest, it's confusing. That's why you need Magic Buzz, a new marketing company so unique, we've even coined a special phrase for what we do. Socio-viral. We combine the word-of-mouth friendliness of social media, like Facebook, Twitter, together with the viral reach power of YouTube, to create the socio-viral effect. The Magic Buzz team makes sure our clients are well represented online. We recently took word-of-mouth advertising to the number one position as most productive medium for a major cell phone company. That's right. Magic Buzz produced more sales than an expensive TV campaign at a fraction of the cost. Put the power of socio-viral marketing to work for you. Visit us at magicbuzz.com. M-A-G-I-C-B-U-Z.com. If you have any questions, please feel free to email us at info@magicbuzz.com. Magic Buzz. We're there when you can't be.
Checking lists of top New England writers, the name Chris Bajalian kept coming up. Since I was not familiar with the author or his work, I did the research. Bajalian was originally from New York. After college and a stint at a New York City ad agency, he moved to Lincoln, Vermont. In Lincoln, Bajalian began writing weekly columns for the local newspaper about living in a small town, population 975. The Concord Monitor said of Bajalian during this period, "His immersion in community life and family, Vermont style, has allowed him to develop into a novelist with an ear and empathy for the common man," unquote. Bajalian continued the column for 12 years while writing for major magazines. He also began writing novels. Bajalian's fifth book, Midwives, was selected as the October 98 pick of Oprah's Book Club. More novels followed. In 2008, Bajalian released Skeletons at the Feast, a love story set at the end of World War II in Poland and Germany. The book was considered quite a departure for Bajalian because it was set outside of Vermont. An enormous commercial and critical success, it was his fifth New York Times bestseller and was selected as Best Book of the Year by the Washington Post. Today, we're going to preview his newest title, The Sandcastle Girls, his 15th novel. The book, a sweeping historical love story steeped in the author's Armenian heritage, has at its core Turkey's denial of its attempt at Armenian genocide. Oprah Winfrey chose it as Book of the Week. When Elizabeth Endicott arrives in Syria, the First World War is spreading across Europe, and she has volunteered on behalf of a Boston-based Friends of Armenia to deliver food and medical aid to refugees of the genocide. There, Elizabeth becomes friendly with Armen, a young Armenian engineer who has already lost his wife and infant daughter. When Armen leaves Aleppo to join the British Army in Egypt, he begins to write Elizabeth and comes to realize he's fallen in love with the wealthy young American woman. Flash forward to the present, where we meet Laura Petrosian, a novelist living in New York. Laura has never really given her Armenian heritage much thought. But when an old friend calls, claiming to have seen a newspaper photo of Laura's grandmother, Laura embarks on a journey back through her family's history to reveal love, loss, and a secret buried for generations. As the Washington Post Book World has noted, Bajalian writes, quote, "the sorts of books people stay awake all night to finish." Cassandra Campbell and Allison Fraser narrate.
And so there she rests and breathes in deeply and slowly through her mouth, watching the women in their headscarves and long loose robes. Some hide all but their eyes behind burkas, and the men in their ornate blazers, their voluminous shapeless trousers and their flowerpot-like fez hats. Some of the men glance at her sympathetically as they pass, others with a brazen want in their eyes. She has been warned.
"There's a nice breeze today," Ryan says cheerfully, and while she appreciates the slightly cooler air, wafting along with it is the stench from the square. "Before you arrived, the heat was just unbearable."
She can't imagine it being hotter. At the moment, she can't imagine anywhere being hotter. And yet she found their apartment last night unexpectedly comfortable after the endless weeks aboard a ship, then a horse-drawn carriage, and finally two train cars that boasted only wooden seats. It was warm, but she had stood at her window for nearly half an hour in the middle of the night, gazing out at the row of statuesque cypress on the hill beyond the American compound, and the bower of trees just inside the walls. She saw more stars than she ever saw in Boston, and the half-moon seemed to dangle eerily, beautifully close to the earth. Her father is surveying the rows of sand-colored two-story buildings that curl toward an alley, his arms folded across his chest, his face stern. And then she notes him arch his back suddenly and stand up a little straighter. Ryan sees what he sees and murmurs just loud enough for her to hear.
"Oh, Jesus. No, not more."
Both Ryan and her father glance down at her, but they realize there is absolutely nothing they can do. There is not a way in the world to shield her from what is coming. Besides, this is why she is here, isn't it? Didn't she volunteer to be a part of this aid mission? To chronicle what she sees for their organization, the Friends of Armenia, and to volunteer at the hospital, to do, in essence, whatever she could to help. Still, discomfort leaches from both men like perspiration, and she finds it interesting that they are as embarrassed as they are disgusted. If they had been here alone, if she had remained back at the American compound, her father and the American consul now would be experiencing only rage. And so she presses the palm of her hand against the wall of the house, the stone unexpectedly cool, and rises. Approaching from down the street is a staggering column of old women, and she is surprised to observe they are African. She stares, transfixed. She thinks of the paintings and drawings she has seen of American slave markets in the South from the 1840s and 1850s, though weren't those women and men always clothed, if only in rags? These women are completely naked, bare from their feet to the long drapes of matted black hair. And it is the hair, long and straight, though filthy and impossibly tangled, that causes her to understand that these women are white. At least they were once. And they are, in fact, not old at all. Many might be her age or even a little younger. All are beyond modesty, beyond caring. Their skin has been seared black by the sun or stained by the soil in which they have slept, or in some cases, by great yawning scabs and wounds that are open and festering, and even at this distance, malodorous. The women look like dying wild animals as they lurch forward, some holding onto the walls of the stone houses to remain erect. She has never in her life seen people so thin, and wonders how in the name of God their bony legs can support them. Their breasts are lost to their ribs. The bones of their hips protrude like baskets.
"Elizabeth, you don't need to watch," her father is saying.
But she does. She does. Herding the women forward through the town are half a dozen young men, two on horseback, who look nearly as weak as the women, and four walking beside the group. All of them have rifles slung over their shoulders. They, too, don't look any older than Elizabeth. And it crosses her mind that the pair nearest her can't be more than 15 or 16. Their mustaches are wisps, a boy's attempt to look like a man.
That was The Sandcastle Girls by Chris Bojalian. I can still remember reading The World According to Garp back in the late 70s, and I loved it, didn't you? New Hampshire's John Irving's newest work, In One Person, is a compelling novel of desire, secrecy, and sexual identity. Billy, the bisexual narrator and main character, tells the tragic comic story of his life as a sexual suspect, a phrase first used by Irving in 78 in his landmark novel of terminal cases, The World According to Garp. His most political novel since The Cider House Rules, In One Person, is a poignant tribute to Billy's friends and lovers, a theatrical cast of characters who defy category and convention. It is an intimate and unforgettable portrait of a solitary bisexual man dedicated to making himself worthwhile. John Benjamin Hickey performs the work.
My aunt claimed that the available men in the town used to fall all over themselves when they met Miss Frost. When one of them got up the nerve to introduce himself, to actually tell Miss Frost his name, the then beautiful librarian would look at him coldly and icily say, "My name is Miss Frost. Never been married, never want to be." With that attitude, Miss Frost was still unmarried when I met her. Inconceivably to me, the available men in the town of First Sister had long stopped introducing themselves to her. The crucial Dickens novel, the one that made me want to be a writer, or so I'm always saying, was Great Expectations. I'm sure I was 15, both when I first read it and when I first reread it. I know this was before I began to attend the academy, because I got the book from the First Sister Town Library, twice. I won't forget the day I showed up at the library to take that book out a second time. I'd never wanted to reread an entire novel before. Miss Frost gave me a penetrating look. At the time, I doubt I was as tall as her shoulders. Miss Frost was once what they call statuesque, my aunt had told me, as if even Miss Frost's height and shape existed only in the past. She was forever statuesque to me. Miss Frost was a woman with an erect posture and broad shoulders, though it was chiefly her small but pretty breasts that got my attention. In seeming contrast to her mannish size and obvious physical strength, Miss Frost's breasts had a newly developed appearance, the improbable but budding look of a young girl's. I couldn't understand how it was possible for an older woman to have achieved this look, but surely her breasts had seized the imagination of every teenage boy who'd encountered her, or so I believed when I met her. When was it? In 1955. Furthermore, you must understand that Miss Frost never dressed suggestively, at least not in the imposed silence of the forlorn First Sister Public Library. Day or night, no matter the hour, there was scarcely anyone there. I had overheard my imperious aunt say to my mother, "Miss Frost is past an age where training bras suffice." At 13, I'd taken this to mean that, in my judgmental aunt's opinion, Miss Frost's bras were all wrong for her breasts, or vice versa. I thought not. And the entire time I was internally agonizing over my and my aunt's different fixations with Miss Frost's breasts, the daunting librarian went on giving me the aforementioned penetrating look. I'd met her at 13. At this intimidating moment, I was 15, but given the invasiveness of Miss Frost's long, lingering stare, it felt like a 2-year penetrating look to me. "Finally," she said, in regard to my wanting to read Great Expectations again, "you've already read this one, William." "Yes, I loved it," I told her, this in lieu of blurting out, as I almost did, that I loved her. She was austerely formal, the first person to unfailingly address me as William. I was always called Bill or Billy by my family and friends. I wanted to see Miss Frost wearing only her bra, which, in my interfering aunt's view, offered insufficient restraint. Yet in lieu of blurting out such an indiscretion as that, I said, I want to reread Great Expectations. Not a word about my premonition that Miss Frost had made an impression on me that would be no less devastating than the one that Estella makes on poor Pip. So soon? Miss Frost asked. You read Great Expectations only a month ago. I can't wait to reread it, I said. There are a lot of books by Charles Dickens, Miss Frost told me. You should try a different one, William. Oh, I will, I assured her. But first I want to reread this one.
We've just heard In One Person by John Irving. André Dubus III grew up in mill towns along the Massachusetts-New Hampshire border. He began writing fiction at age 22, just a few months after graduating from UT Austin. Because he preferred to write in the morning, he took mainly night jobs, bartender, office cleaner, halfway house counselor, and even as an assistant to a private investigator. André has taught writing at Harvard, Tufts, Emerson College, and UMass Lowell, where he is a full-time faculty member. André is the author of 5 books. His novel, House of Sand and Fog, was a fiction finalist for the National Book Award and an Academy Award-nominated motion picture. Today, we're going to speak with him about his most recent book, his memoir, Townie. Welcome, André. Thanks so much for stopping by the Book Report.
Thanks for having me, Elaine. It's nice to be here.
How and when did you begin to write?
Oh, it's a long story, but I'll get to it. I began to write when I was about 21 and a half, 22 years old. I was a kid who got beat up a lot growing up, moved a lot, lived in kind of first world poverty, and I snapped and became a fighter and a pretty violent, angry kid. And one night, and in one way to control my violence, I actually started to box. And one night, instead of going off to the gym to box, something I still can't pinpoint but makes me believe in, frankly, the divine, made me sit my butt in a chair and write a scene. And I just felt so alive and awake, and I felt, you know, more importantly, I felt more like myself than I'd ever felt. That I've been writing 5-6 days a week since because of that feeling, and that was, you know, 30 years ago.
You described Townie as an accidental memoir. How so?
Accidental and reluctant. Well, I was working on an essay, in a collection of essays to deliver to my publisher. And because I love the personal essay as a form. And the essay I was working on was kind of fueled by the question, how did I miss baseball? I love baseball now as a grown-up, so why didn't I play it as a kid? Why didn't I even watch it? And, you know, I know why. You know, we most of us really know the story of how we got to where we are now, but just because we know what happened, I maintain we don't know really what the hell happened. You know, and that's one reason we go back in the memoir and we go back in our memories. And so I began to write this essay about baseball, and 500 pages later, I wrote what I was doing instead of playing, you know, sports with balls in them. I was living with my mom and 3 siblings after she divorced my father, and living pretty low income, and living in tough neighborhoods, and you know, that's how it started. And you know, for years, I've been trying to write so much of this as fiction. And I finally came to the conclusion after 3 separate attempts, Elaine. I don't exaggerate, I think, when I say that probably out of the last close to 30 years of fiction writing, I probably spent 8 or 9 years trying to write all that stuff that ended up in Townie as a novel. And I just couldn't do it. I was too close to it. And more importantly, I think, I realized that I'm not the kind of writer who can write fiction from my life. One of the things I love about writing novels and stories is you get to be someone else. And I felt hemmed in by the facts of my life. And so writing Townie, it felt really artistically freeing that I finally found a way to talk about growing up in the early 70s, you know, Vietnam ending, Nixon taking off in his helicopter, no dads around, a lot of drugs and alcohol and sex too young, and I finally found a way to write about it.
Your book is so gut-wrenchingly honest. How did your family react to it?
Oh, man. I have a hitman out front waiting. No, they were wonderfully, surprisingly generous. I mean, they just... well, my younger sister, Nicole, has told me that she's not going to read it. and nothing personal. She said, I'll read your fiction, but I just, it was a lousy childhood and I don't care to go back. And I completely respect that. My brother Jeb was incredibly generous. You know, I was particularly worried about him because I wrote a bit about his own demons. And in order to write more honestly about my life, I discovered I had to write more honestly about my family's, which was the most difficult part of writing this. And he said to me, man, he said, well, Andre, I'd never want to step on anybody's tube of paint. You know, my sister was equally generous. My mother was, oh, so beautiful. She actually said, she said, you know, Andre, I was, you know, I'm driving, and we're driving side by side, and I'm trying to explain to her that I'm written this memoir, and I have to be really honest about my memory of how she kind of just was holding on by her fingertips as a mother. But I didn't want to hurt her or make her look bad in any way. You know, I love her, and I honor what she did do. And she said, well, she reached over. She said, don't you dare. I go, oh, God, it's too late. She said, no, don't you dare not write anything because of me. She said, you write your story. She said, you know, that's your story and you have to write it. And she said, besides, I'm so old, I just don't give a shit what anyone thinks about me anyway.
Well, man, that lady had grit. I mean, yeah. There's stories so tough.
Yeah, and you know, I my wife and I have talked about this. If I were a really wealthy guy, I would set up a fund just for single mothers raising their kids in poverty, I mean, which is millions and millions of women and kids. And she was one of them. She, you know, and also one of the things I discovered in this accidental memoir, Townie Elaine, is that, you know, my family was also from a social class we don't really talk about much in this country, which is they were educated. They're from the educated working poor. They were both educated. They both had jobs. But, you know, my father made about $12,000 a year. My mother made about $10,000 a year. And they just never had enough. And I think there are a lot of people like that, educated but broke.
Especially now.
Especially now. It's happening even more.
Your dad passed away before the book was published, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes, he did. I don't believe I could have written it if you were alive, because so much of what surprised me about what came out of that story, that remembered story of my youth, is his absence in our lives became a huge presence in the book. And I actually realized that I was, you know, more fatherless than I ever consciously accepted.
You come from a really literary family. When you do some digging in the family tree, there's a lot of people there. Talk about that.
I think it's in the water or something. Yeah, man, my dad, of course, is a beautiful short story writer, Andre Debuse, and his first cousin is the 2-time Edgar Award-winning master crime writer James Lee Burke with his 30-something books. And then his daughter, Alifair Burke, just published her 7th book. And then my father's sister, Elizabeth Nell Debuse, published 5 historical novels. And her daughter, Delaney Michelle, is coming out with the 3rd book. And there are actually more in when you go out from that immediate family.
And as a kid, you actually knew Kurt Vonnegut.
Yeah, Kurt Vonnegut, actually, I didn't know who the hell he was. He was just this tall guy with curly hair who, in Iowa City, when my dad was at the writer's workshop and my parents were still happily married and in their 20s, he would come down, walk down from his house up the street and come to our house because our grandmother bought us a little black and white TV, and every day we watched Batman at like 3 o'clock. And there'd be this Uncle Kurt guy chain-smoking cigarettes right beside us on the couch and watching Batman. I remember one time, I mean, I put this in the book, you know, I remember vividly him looking down at me once and asking me who my favorite character was. And I said, you know, False Face? And he says, I like the Riddler. And he kept smoking.
Wow. I watched a YouTube interview of yours, and you said you love addressing audiences. You love reading excerpts, but you love the Q&A the most. What's a question that you've never been asked that you really wish you could be asked?
You know, Elaine, it's a great question. That's a great question right there. Here's my answer. I can't think of a question that I haven't been asked or that I would want anyone to ask. And mainly it's because I try not to think too much about... Here's what I'm trying to say. I try to be so in the moment and so completely there in the room with whoever is there when I'm in front of people that I don't think about the conversation before. I don't think about it after. My favorite part of that Q&A is, especially with the huge book tour of the memoirs, you just get so tired of yourself. You get so tired of your damn book and your little depressing story and your stupid name. And so I just take refuge in other people. Tell me about you. So what do you do?
Well, hardly depressing really at the end because, you know, you're such a fabulous man now.
Oh, well, thank you. I don't know if I'm a fabulous man, but it's one day at a time.
How was it for you to narrate your own audiobook?
It was fun, and I didn't think it would be because I was tired of my book. I'd already edited it so much, and it had been about 6 months since I looked at the manuscript. But I was really grateful to have those 10 days in that studio with this guy. Really, with the audio company, I really got to like this young guy, was my director, tech guy, and distance between finishing the last period of the last sentence. And so I was really allowing myself to see it with new eyes, which is the heart of revision. So it was too late to do anything about it because it's already a book. So I was allowing myself to just go on that journey with this kid, Andre. And you know, frankly, it was fun to do the accents. You know, like, you know, Northern Boston, where I'm from, they all talk like this. Lane, how you doing, honey? Nice. Hey, that's a nice thing you got there. What's that? Cost you a lot of money there? So it was fun, you know, doing that.
Okay, so what's next for you?
Nothing. I'm not working on a thing. No. You know, one thing I'm going to talk about tonight with these writers is this whole notion of the writing, being a writer being versus being an author. And I'm very grateful that I'm an author, which means you publish things. But what I love about writing is writing. So I write 5-6 days a week all year long. And right now I'm working on a book I'm trying to finish by Christmas. And if it goes longer, it goes longer. But it's kind of it's a collection of vaguely linked novellas that have to do with, you know, being middle-aged and married and middle-aged sex and grown kids and growing kids and hurt feelings and changing bodies. And, you know, I'm trying to listen to William Carlos Williams and write what's under my nose, which is, you know, middle-aged people. Although I will tell you that the latest novella, which is an unusual title for me, but it's 97 pages long, and I finished it a few months ago, and it's called Listen Carefully as Our Options Have Changed.
I love that.
It's modern for me, but go ahead.
Right. Well, your book is so moving. Readers, absolutely pick it up next time you're in a bookstore. Thanks so much for stopping by.
Elaine, thank you. I really enjoyed it.
And now, let's hear a sampling of Townie, read by the author.
This was the 60s and early 70s. Nobody jogged then. It was a habit he'd formed in the Marine Corps, and when he ran down the road, people would shout from their lawns and ask if he needed any help. Where was he going? I had run with him once before when I was 8 years old. It was at our old house in the woods in New Hampshire, one with land to play on, a clear brook in the trees. It was a summer day when Mom and Pop were still married, and Pop had asked me and Jeb if we wanted to go with him. We said yes, though Jeb lost interest pretty quickly and walked back down the country road Pop and I kept running on. I lagged a few feet behind him, the sun on my face, sweat burning my eyes. At the 1 mile mark, he turned around and I followed him home where he left me and set back out on a longer run. But I'd run 2 miles, and when I stepped inside our cool, dark house, I yelled up the stairs to Mom, "I ran 2 miles with Daddy, Mom. I'm strong. I'm strong." And I punched the wall and could feel the plaster and lath behind the wallpaper, though I had no words for them. Now I was twice that age and hadn't run since, and even though my feet hurt with each stride, it felt good to be running outside with Pop on his birthday, spending time with him that wasn't in a restaurant he couldn't afford on a Sunday, that wasn't in a small apartment every fourth Wednesday. It was easier not having to look directly at him across a table, to have him sometimes look directly at me. And this was a part of town I didn't even know about. For a while, it was hard to believe it was the same town as the one I spent all my time in. We were running on a wide dirt trail under a canopy of leafy branches. To our left, the trees grew on a slope and leaned over the water. To our right was a steep wooded hill, the ground a bed of pine needles and moss-covered rock, deep green ferns growing up around fallen logs and bare branches. I was in weight training shape, not running shape. And 15 minutes into it, I could hear myself breathing harder than he was. But I didn't let myself fall behind him, and I found if I relaxed my toes each time I lifted a foot, then tensed them just before it hit the ground again, the pain wasn't quite as sharp. I figured I'd have to do this another 30 minutes, maybe 45, just two or three times what we'd already done. I could do that, right? The trail dropped closer to the water, and for a quarter mile or so, we were running on flat ground, water on both sides of us, marsh grass and lily pads and waterlogged trees that had been there for years. Then the hills came. They were short and steep, and Pop told me to run up them hard, that it was easier that way. I did, my heart punching my ribs, my breathing coming too shallow when I was inhaling as deeply as I could. Pop was 8 or 10 feet ahead of me now. Then I put my head down, pumped my arms and legs, and tried to ignore the stabs in my soles, the vice on my toes, the metal grater on my heels. The hill leveled off in the shade, then dropped mercifully before another rose up like a rock-strewn wave, and now my eyes were stinging from the sweat, and I closed them and ran as hard as I could, my thighs burning, the air in my lungs gone for good. There were 5 or 6 more like this, and with each one we rose higher from the water down to our left. To our right was the rise of another densely wooded hill, so shaded it looked cool, and Pop was breathing much easier than I was, his bandana dark with sweat. He seemed to slow himself so I could pull up beside him. The big one's coming up. Big one? You'll see. He laughed, and soon enough the trail cut hard to the east, and he ran ahead of me. I followed, but this was the steepest hill yet. And when I looked ahead, I saw only that it kept rising and rising before it curved into more trees where it rose again. My mouth and throat were thick and tasted like salt. My thighs hurt almost as much as my feet, and even though I was pumping my arms and legs as fast as I could, I seemed to be barely moving. I couldn't see my father anymore. I closed my eyes and kept running. Pop was waiting for me at the top, running in place, his beard glistening in the dappled light. He was smiling at me. When I got to where he was, we ran side by side down a long, winding trail in the shade. It wasn't until we were on flat ground again, water on both sides of us, maybe a mile and a half before we were through, that he said, "You up for the second lap?" "Yeah." I assumed the second lap meant the home stretch we were running, the same trail we'd used on the way in. I didn't know then that on his birthday every year he would double or triple his normal running distance. That the second lap meant another 5.5 miles after I somehow got through these.
That was Townie by Andre Debus. Author Julia Glass won the National Book Award for Fiction in 2002. But the Book Report has to fess up. We were not familiar with this New England author. Glass was born in Boston and attended Yale. With her heart set on becoming a painter, she moved to New York. She lived and painted in a small Brooklyn studio, but supported herself as a freelance editor and copy editor, including several years in the copy department of Cosmopolitan magazine. As her writing career progressed, she moved back to New England and now lives in Marblehead. Her debut novel, Three Junes, won the National Book Award for Fiction. The Widower's Tale, which we'll preview today, is her 4th novel. In a historic farmhouse outside of Boston, 70-year-old Percy Darling is settling happily into retirement, reading novels, watching old movies, and swimming naked in his pond. His routines are disrupted, however, when he is persuaded to let a locally beloved preschool take over his barn. As Percy sees his rural refuge overrun by children, parents, and teachers, he re-examines his solitary life. No longer can he remain aloof from his community, his 2 grown daughters, or, to his shock, the precarious joy of falling in love. With equal parts affection and satire, Glass spins a captivating tale about loyalties, rivalries, and secrets of a family. Mark Bramall narrates.
Had he been a boy of his age some 20 years ago, I would have known his name without a second thought, not just because I would have known his parents, but because in all likelihood he would have mowed my lawn or painted my barn. Gratefully, for an hourly wage appropriate to a teenage boy's modestly spendthrift habits. Nowadays, teenage boys with wealthy parents do not mow lawns or paint houses. If they stoop to any sort of paid activity, they help seasoned citizens learn to navigate the baffling world of computers and entertainment modules, charging an hourly wage more appropriate to the appallingly profligate habits of a drug dealer in the Bronx. Damius, or Darian, might indeed have been the one to coach my own seasoned self through the use of my new laptop computer, a retirement gift that spring from my daughters, and to fleece me accordingly, had I not been the fortunate grandfather of a very intelligent, very kind, adequately well-mannered boy of 20, who was, at the time, an honors student at Harvard. A good boy, as parents no longer dare to say, cowed by advice from some celebrity pediatrician who's probably fathered two or three litters with a sequence of abandoned wives. But that's what Robert was to me, and still is, or is again, despite everything that's happened. A good boy, on the verge of becoming a solid, productive citizen. My grandson is a very good boy, I used to say, with pride and confidence, especially within earshot of his mother. Robert had inherited his mother's passion for science, and I had begun to assume, with mixed feelings, that he planned to follow in her professional footsteps, a successful oncologist in Boston. Trudy has become marginally famous as a media source whenever some new Scandinavian study pops up to hint at anything approaching a cure. One day, watching her as she explained a controversial drug to that life-size Ken doll on the 6 o'clock news, it occurred to me that my younger daughter entered my living room more often as a guest of NBC than as my flesh-and-blood offspring. I saw Robert far more frequently. Robert stayed in close touch with me, as contractors, carpenters, plumbers, and electricians jacked up and tore apart my barn so that it could become the new home of elves and fairies, Matlock's favorite progressive nursery school. Simply to look out my back windows that summer felt like spying on the public humiliation of a loyal friend, an ordeal I had engineered. When these callow strangers, few of whom spoke English by choice, were not perpetrating their mutilations, buttressings, and vigorous eviscerations upon that stately structure, they treated my entire property like an amusement park. During breaks, they would kick a soccer ball back and forth by the pond, and while there were plenty of other shady spots in which to lounge, they ate their lunch on the steps of my back porch, their laughter and indecipherable chit-chat echoing throughout my house. I could not even identify the language they shared. It might have been Tagalog or Farsi.
That was The Widower's Tale by Julia Glass. Robert Brown Parker, son of Springfield, Mass., is an icon of American crime writing. His most famous works feature the private eye Spencer, the inspiration for the TV series Spencer for Hire. Parker was 77 when he died of a heart attack at his home in Cambridge. He was discovered at his desk where he had been working on his next novel. The Spencer novels have been cited by critics with reviving and changing the detective genre. Rough Weather, which we'll preview now, is book 36 in the Spencer series. Heidi Bradshaw is wealthy, beautiful, and well-connected, and she needs Spencer's help. In a most unlikely request, Heidi, a notorious gold digger, recently separated from her latest husband, recruits the Boston PI to accompany her to her private island for her daughter's wedding. Spencer is unsure of what his role as a personal bodyguard will entail, but he consents. It should be a straightforward job for him. Show up, have some drinks, and enjoy the island. Yet, when his old nemesis Ruger, the gray man, arrives on the island, Spencer realizes something is amiss. With a hurricane brewing, the gray man jumps into action, firing fatal shots into the crowd of wedding guests and kidnapping the bride. but Spencer knows that sloppy guns-for-hire abduction is not Ruger's style. Unable to prevent the attack, Spencer has to decide who the real enemy is before more people end up dead. Joe Montagna narrates.
I want you to be the man I can turn to if I need something. Will you want me to provide security in the more conventional sense as well? No, the island has its own security patrol. You are there to support me. Unless your therapy kicks in before October, I said. Unless that, she said, or a whirlwind romance. I nodded. May I bring a guest? What kind of guest? She said. A stunning Jewess with a PhD from Harvard. Wife? Not exactly, I said. Girlfriend? Sort of, I said. Think of her as the one. Why do you want to bring her? I miss her when I'm not with her, I said, and it'll make me feel less like a gigolo. She laughed out loud. You're so cute, she said. Of course, bring the one. Would you like to talk costs, I said. She took a green leather checkbook out of her purse. Not very much, she said. May I pay you a large retainer? Good start, I said. Chapter 2. I was having dinner with the one at a new place called Sorrelina. You know, of course, who Heidi Bradshaw is, Susan said. My client. Besides that, Susan said. She's famous, I said. Do you know for what? Besides being my client, I said. Besides that, Susan said. I guess she's famous for being famous, I said. The room was large and not loud. The tables were well spaced. There were windows where you could look out at Copley Square. The service was good. I was paying with a small part of Heidi Bradshaw's swell advance, and I was with the girl of my dreams. She has been married to some of the richest men in the world, Susan said. And profited from each marriage, I said. Any girl would, Susan said. How did she find you? Maybe she Googled stud on the internet? I've tried that, Susan said. You're not listed. Damn, I said. So, how did they end up with you? Somebody called somebody, I said, and one thing led to another. Okay, and if it worked that way, what would be the basis for recommending you? I'm a great husband substitute, I said. Probably not, Susan said. That I'm a tough guy and I own a gun, I said. Probably so, Susan said. We were quiet for a moment. Susan had some sort of exotic fish. She took a small bite. Susan always took small bites. She ate slowly and rarely ate all of what she ordered. I had pasta, all of which I guzzled. I thought of that, I said. Me too, Susan said. So why do you hire a guy with a gun to hang around your party? Because you're afraid, Susan said. Even though the island has its own security. Even though, Susan said. Maybe you're afraid of the security, I said. Maybe she thinks they're incompetent. For Christ's sake, I said, it's her island. They are her security. Susan shrugged and nibbled on her fish. I finished the last meatball. Susan took a small sip of wine. Well, whatever the reason, she said, she feels the need to augment it. With one guy? Apparently, Susan said, which is why the one guy is you. Shucks, I said. Which means they went looking for you, Susan said, or someone like you. Which means maybe I should bring two guns? One should be enough, Susan said. You are, after all, bringing me.
That was Rough Weather by Robert B. Parker. One night this month, I stayed up way too late to watch The Late Late Show. Craig Ferguson had both Stephen King and my pal Dave Barry on. Anyway, when Craig was interviewing King, the legendary maniac, and by that I mean Maine resident, King talked at length about it, an early work he said he was very fond of. Okay, that's reason enough for the book report to bring it to you now. They were just kids when they stumbled upon a horrific incident in their hometown. Now, as adults, none of the group can withstand the force that has drawn them all back to Derry, Maine, to face the nightmare without end and the evil without a name. Stephen Weber narrates the work that critics say was King's return to pure horror, pitting good against evil.
About 3/4 of the way down the block, as one headed toward the intersection and the dead traffic light, Witcham Street was blocked to motor traffic by smudge pots and 4 orange sawhorses. Stenciled across each of the horses was Derry Department of Public Works. Beyond them, the rain had spilled out of gutters clogged with branches and rocks and big sticky piles of autumn leaves. The water had first pried fingerholds in the paving, and then snatched whole greedy handfuls. All of this by the 3rd day of the rains. By noon of the 4th day, big chunks of the street's surface were boating through the intersection of Jackson and Witcham like miniature whitewater rafts. By that time, many people in Derry had begun to make nervous jokes about arcs. The Public Works Department had managed to keep Jackson Street open, but Witcham was impassable from the sawhorses all the way to the center of town. But everyone agreed the worst was over. The Kanduskeag stream had crested just below its banks in the barrens and bare inches below the concrete sides of the canal, which channeled it tightly as it passed through downtown. Right now, a gang of men, Zach Dembro, George's and Bill's father among them, were removing the sandbags they had thrown up the day before with such panicky haste. Yesterday, overflow and expensive flood damage had seemed almost inevitable. God knew it had happened before. The flooding in 1931 had been a disaster, which had cost millions of dollars and almost 2 dozen lives. That was a long time ago, but there were still enough people around who remembered it to scare the rest. One of the flood victims had been found 25 miles east, in Bucksport. The fish had eaten this unfortunate gentleman's eyes, 3 of his fingers, his penis, and most of his left foot. Clutched in what remained of his hands had been a Ford steering wheel. Now, though, the river was receding, and when the new Bangor Hydro Dam went in upstream, the river would cease to be a threat. Or so said Zach Dembro, who worked for Bangor Hydroelectric. As for the rest, well, future floods could take care of themselves. The thing was to get through this one, to get the power back on, and then to forget it. In Derry, such forgetting of tragedy and disaster was almost an art, as Bill Denbro would come to discover in the course of time. George paused, just beyond the sawhorses at the edge of a deep ravine that had been cut through the tar surface of Witcham Street. This ravine ran on an almost exact diagonal. It ended on the far side of the street, roughly 40 feet farther down the hill, from where he now stood, on the right. He laughed aloud, the sound of solitary, childish glee, a bright runner in that gray afternoon, as a vagary of the flowing water took his paper boat into a scale model rapids, which had been formed by the break in the tar. The urgent water had cut a channel which ran along the diagonal, and so his boat traveled from one side of Witcham Street to the other, the current carrying it so fast that George had to sprint to keep up with it. Water sprayed out from beneath his galoshes in muddy sheets. Their buckles made a jolly jingling as George Dembro ran toward his strange death. And the feeling which filled him at that moment was clear and simple love for his brother Bill. Love and a touch of regret that Bill couldn't be here to see this and be a part of it. Of course, he would try to describe it to Bill when he got home, but he knew he wouldn't be able to make Bill see it the way Bill would have been able to make him see it if their positions had been reversed. Bill was good at reading and writing, but even at his age, George was wise enough to know that wasn't the only reason why Bill got all A's on his report cards or why his teachers liked his compositions so well. Telling was only part of it. Bill was good at seeing. The boat nearly whistled along the diagonal channel, just a page torn from the classified section of the Derry News, but now George imagined it as a PT boat in a war movie, like the ones he sometimes saw down at the Derry Theater with Bill at Saturday matinees. A war picture, with John Wayne fighting the Japs. The prow of the newspaper boat threw sprays of water to either side as it rushed along, and then it reached the gutter on the left side of Witcham Street. A fresh streamlet rushed over the break in the tar at this point, creating a fairly large whirlpool, and it seemed to him that the boat must be swamped and capsize.
We've just heard It by Stephen King. Born and raised in Lowell, Mass., Eleanor Lippman studied journalism in college, but went on to write novels. Her novel, Then She Found Me, was adapted into a 2007 feature film, directed by and starring Helen Hunt. In her novel, The Family Man, a hysterical phone call from his ex-wife upends Henry Archer's well-ordered life and brings him back into contact with his daughter, Thalia, now 29 and an aspiring actress. Hoping it will lead to better things for her career, Thalia has agreed to pose as the girlfriend of a horror movie luminary down on his romantic luck. When Thalia and her complicated social life move into the basement of Henry's Upper West Side townhouse, she finds a champion in her long-lost dad, and he finds new life and maybe even new love in the commotion. Jonathan Davis narrates.
Henry Archer did not attend his ex-wife's husband's funeral, but he did send a note of condolence. The former Denise Archer wrote back immediately and urgently. Would he believe, after 24 reasonably happy years, that life as she knew it had been snatched out from under her? Her postscript said, "Your number's unlisted. Call me." And there it was, a bridge he'd never planned to cross. His quiet greeting, "It's Henry Archer, Denise," provoked an audible sob. She quickly clarified that it wasn't bereavement he was hearing in her voice, but relief, a sense she'd been thrown a lifeline. "Me?" he asked. Could he stand hearing the whole sordid story? Had he known that Glenn Crouch had two sons from another marriage? Because they were getting everything, every last thing, except the clothes, the furs, the jewelry, and one signed Picasso, which was only a pencil sketch. Was he sitting down? Because some famously heartless lawyer had set 25 years of marriage as the watershed anniversary after which the prenuptial agreement would deem her long-suffering enough to be a true wife and not some piece of... It was, in the opinion of two lawyers, husbands of friends, not their area of expertise, should she get a third or fourth opinion, a hideously airtight legal document. And now these stepsons were taking the will so literally, as if 24 faithful years didn't render a prenup null, void, and vicious. How many times had she asked Glenn if he'd updated his will, meaning, "Am I in it?" To which he'd always said, "Yes, of course." The "of course" amounted to a monthly allowance under the thumb of older son and executor Glenn Jr. Horrible! And so much for Glenn Sr.'s famous love for Thalia. Henry remembered Thalia, didn't he? Another indignity. Thalia's portion was in trust until she was 35. How condescending and sexist was that? Had she mentioned that these sons, not even 35 themselves, were not only Glenn's favorite children, but his business partners as well? And who but she, the reviled stepmother, had arranged every detail of the black tie party celebrating the addition of "and sons" to all signage, and had invited the boy's mother, and seated her at the head table?
That was The Family Man by Eleanor Lippman. Dennis Lahane was born and reared in the Dorchester neighborhood of Boston. He continues to live in Boston, which is the setting for most of his books. The book we'll preview today is book 4 of the popular Kenzie and Gennaro series, Gone Baby Gone. The tough neighborhood of Dorchester is no place for the innocent or the weak. A territory defined by the hard heads and even harder luck, its streets are littered with the detritus of broken families. Now, one of its youngest is missing. Private investigators Patrick Kenzie and Angela Gennaro don't want the case. But after pleas from the child's aunt, they open an investigation that will ultimately risk everything, their relationship, their sanity, and even their lives. Jonathan Davis narrates.
He left the city right after Helene got pregnant. Nobody's heard from him since. The list of possible fathers is long, though, Beatrice said. Lionel looked down at the floor. Mr. McCready, I said. He looked at me. Lionel. Please, Lionel, I said. Have a seat. He fitted himself into the small chair on the other side of the desk after a bit of a struggle. This Todd Morgan, Angie said as she finished writing the name on a pad of paper. Do police know his whereabouts? Mannheim, Germany, Beatrice said. He's stationed in the army over there. And he was on the base when Amanda disappeared. Have they discounted him as a suspect? I said. There's no way he would have hired a friend to do it. Lionel cleared his throat, looked at the floor again. The police said he's embarrassed by my sister and doesn't think Amanda is his child anyway. He looked up at me with those lost, gentle eyes of his. They said his response was, if I want a rugrat to and cry all the time, I can have a German one. I could feel the wave of hurt that had washed through him when he'd had to call his niece a rugrat, and I nodded. Tell me about Helene, I said. There wasn't much to tell. Helene McCready was Lionel's youngest sister by 4 years, which put her at 28. She dropped out of Monsignor Ryan Memorial High School in her junior year. Never got the GED she kept saying she would. At 17, she ran off with a guy 15 years older, and they'd lived in a trailer park in New Hampshire for 6 months before Helene returned home with a face bruised purple and the first of 3 abortions behind her. Since then, she'd worked a variety of jobs. Stop and Shop cashier, Chess King clerk, dry cleaner's assistant, UPS receptionist, and never managed to hold on to any for more than 18 months. Since the disappearance of her daughter, she'd taken leave from her part-time job running the lottery machine at Little Peach, and there weren't any indications she'd be going back. She loved that little girl, though, Lionel said. Beatrice looked as if she were of a different opinion, but she kept silent. Where's Helene now? Angie said. At our house, Lionel said. The lawyer we contacted said we should keep her under wraps as long as we can. Why? I said. Why? Lionel said. Yeah, I mean her child's missing. Shouldn't she be making appeals to the public? Canvassing the neighborhood at least? Lionel opened his mouth, then closed it. He looked down at his shoes. Helene is not up to that, Beatrice said. Why not? Angie said. Because she's Helene, Beatrice said. Are the police monitoring the phones at her place in case there's a ransom demand?
Yes, Lionel said.
And she's not there, Angie said.
It got to be too much for her, Lionel said. She needed her privacy.
He held out his hands, looked at us.
Oh, I said. Her privacy.
Of course, Angie said.
Look, Lionel needed his cap again. I know how it seems. I do. But people show their worry in different ways, right?
I gave him a half-hearted nod. If she'd had 3 abortions, I said, and Lionel winced, what made her decide to give birth to Amanda?
I think she decided it was time.
That was Gone, Baby Gone by Dennis Lahane. Readers, I hope you've enjoyed the lowdown from downtown Beantown. The literary landscape goes so much further than Emerson, Thoreau, and the Walden crowd. For top titles from around the country, check my website, bookreportradio.com. Thanks so much for joining me today, and let's meet again here next week for the Book Report.